Good afternoon. It's 4:25, Wednesday, September 11th. This is the TDN Writers Room podcast. I'm Joe Bianca, associate editor at the Thoroughbred Daily News.
This is Bill Finley. I'm a contributor to the Thoroughbred Daily News and co-host a horse racing radio show every Saturday morning with the legendary Dave Johnson on Sirius XM channel 156. Please tune us in.
Hey everyone, this is Alan Carrasso, the managing editor of the TDN, and I've just entered my 22nd year of employment here. Wow. So, and after congrats. That, you know, hey, thanks. So it's great to be on the podcast this week.
So, I mean, I think this is something that regular news broadcasts have to deal with a lot. They have breaking news right before they go on air. Didn't expect it to happen too much on this one, but that's what we have today. About a half hour ago, a filly by American Pharaoh out of Leslie's Lady, making her half-sister to Into Mischief and Beholder and Mendelssohn, hammered for $8.2 million. At Keeneland September, Mandy Pope signed the winning ticket. Just kind of an insane bidding war. The more you watched it, the more you were in disbelief. And Mandy Pope doesn't go with Godolphin and Coolmore every single day, but when she does, she seems to come out on top. So this was the highest price filly ever to sell Keeneland September, right? Yes, Al?
Correct. Yep.
And didn't you say by a $4 million margin?
Yeah, the second highest of the previous record was $4.4 million in 2000.
And tied for the fourth highest overall price at Keeneland September in the 76-year history of the sale. So this was kind of the prized entrant of this sale, I would say. And it kind of was a precursor to this yesterday, because we saw a horse by Curlin go for $4.1 million, saw Warfront go for $2.9 million earlier in the sale. I was looking last year, the whole topper for the entire sale was $2.4 million. I think the year before that was 2.7. You have to go back to Mendelssohn in 2016 to find a $3 million plus horse. So this kind of had the makings of a big time sale, at least at the top. Al, you've been covering Keeneland and the sales for a long time. Does anything surprise you anymore? Does this surprise you?
I mean, you know, the market has been slow to sort of come back to this level. You know, retracing steps and looking at the four biggest horses in September history. In 1 year, in 2006, you had, at the same sale, you had horses sell for 11.7, 9.7, and 8.2. And that was a single buyer. So, I think it's great. You know, the people at Clarkland Farm, the Mitchells, you know, they've small breeders, and to see them have this sort of success. I mean, for Mendelssohn for $3 million was tremendous. And you know, for small breeders to hit a home run year after year, it's you know, it's just a fantastic story for the game.
Alan, continue the story, because you mentioned Mendelssohn. Who are the other famous siblings that this horse, this mare, has produced?
Right. So actually, going back a little bit further, the Mitchells acquired Leslie's Lady, who was a fair racehorse in her own right. She was a stakes-winning two-year-old in 1998. And she came to market at the 2006 Keeneland November sale. She was in foal to Orientate, and she was purchased by the Mitchells for $100,000. Her first two foals were nothing of note, and then 2010 came along, and Leslie's Lady gave birth to a Henny Hughes filly named Beholder.
She was pretty good.
She was okay.
Yeah, she's all right.
She was all right.
Yeah.
You know, and then as fortunes go, then, you know, and Into Mischief had come before that for a different owner and a different breeder. So obviously the success that he's had with his offspring obviously contributed to this. But, you know, how's the old adage go? You breed the best, do the best, and hope for the best. And that looks like what happened today.
I got shortly before he came here, I got a text saying that this horse sold for the $8.2 million, you said it mm-hmm. was, Joe. And I said, who did the horse sell to? And they said, we don't know yet. And right away I knew, Mandy Pope. It couldn't have been anybody else. And, you know, I guess it's, you can't, you, this is nothing you can judge. You can't criticize. Or you can't say she did something smart, because we will have no evidence to answer that question for several years. I mean, so not only will we have to see what this filly does on the racetrack, because she does race her horses. All these very expensive broodmares she's bought over the years, she has not sold the foals back at the sale. She's racing them herself. And then we have to see what this horse can do as a broodmare. So it might be 10 years before we get an explanation or an answer to whether or not this was a wonderful spend or a very foolish spend. But I'll say this much for her. She plays the game at the highest level, and she is not afraid. I wouldn't want to be in a poker game with her, because it would be all in, all in, all in, all in. And, you know, I think I've talked to her once, you know, a very nice lady. But I get the feeling that if she wants something bad enough, she's not going to say no. Yeah. It's just whatever it takes. Now, I think everybody thought that this would probably be the highest price horse in the sale, but eight plus million, that was shocking.
Yeah, it really was head spinning. And just to go back to the Clarkland thing, you know, I think a lot of times with these horses, we kind of forget about them unless they do something on the racetrack. A lot of the sales results kind of gets, you know, pushed out to see when the horses don't become superstars. But I think the stuff that you really remember are these success stories. You know, Leslie's Lady was $100,000 purchase, as you said, at Keeneland November. And that's the kind of stuff that lives on in legend and lore in horse racing, because whether or not this particular filly turns out to be a star, I think that's a one-of-a-kind story. And that's the kind of story you can only really find in racing, you know, in terms of the major sports.
And, you know, interestingly enough, Beholder of these offspring, I think she cost, it's not here on my sheet here, but if memory serves, I think she cost something around $180,000.
But she was bred to a pretty modest sire in Henny Hughes.
Definitely, yeah. Was. Yeah. I mean, obviously they saw something with the Stormcat line. So you had Into Mischief by Harlan Soliday, who's by Harlan, by Stormcat. And, you know, so obviously they saw something there that they wanted to stick with and guessed on Henny Hughes. I mean, a sprinter miler, you know, at his best, and you know, through a horse like Beholder, just an incredible Hall of Fame quality horse.
Speaks well for the mayor. Joe, I thought we were going to come in, and 2 hours ago when we were emailing each other, how are we going to start this conversation off? Well, it's all going to be about Sheikh Mohammed. Because until Manny Pope blew Sheikh Mohammed off the front page, this was a sale that was all about him. He had, I don't know what happened earlier in the day, but coming into the day, he had bought the four highest-priced horses at the sale, including a $4.1 million Curlin colt that obviously he must have had his eye on and was willing to part with a lot of money in there. He bought a $2.5 million Tappet, a $2.15 million Medaglia d'Oro. I think my notes, I can't never read my handwriting, but I think another one was a $2.9 million War Front. So, you know, he came here loaded with bear. And I've got a theory behind this, especially with the Curlin, that there's no way that Curlin's going to Europe. Not with that pedigree. You don't send a Curlin to Europe. That's a dirt pedigree. I think this is further evidence that Sheikh Mohammed is, you know, after backing off for a little while, remember, he was going to win the Derby, but he was going to do it his way. The horses were going to come through the UAE. They weren't going to do any of the traditional preps in the U.S., and it was an abysmal failure. Now he's starting to do it the traditional way. Still hasn't had any success. But what was very interesting last year is he started giving horses to Bob Baffert. Now, when you give horses to Bob Baffert, that signals something. That means, okay, I want to win the Kentucky Derby. Who's the best trainer out there in America to win the Kentucky Derby? Bob Baffert. So I think, you know, maybe the $2.5 million Tappet as well, but more so the $4.1 million Curlin. Let's do the math right. So the horse is born in 2018. I think he's hoping he just bought the 2021 Kentucky Derby winner. And I think that the way he has shopped at this sale shows how committed he is and recommitted to winning the Kentucky Derby. I'm already Baffert's had a lot of good two-year-olds with him, a lot of very hyped two-year-olds. A lot of them have not lived up to the hype, but only takes one. And, you know, a guy who's won, you know, virtually every important race in the world, but the Kentucky Derby, I think he's saying, I'm getting this done.
It kind of levels the playing field a little bit when you have these people that have more money than God and unlimited pockets but haven't won the big thing they want to win. It's like, well, you're just one of the other guys who hasn't won the Derby yet. So it adds a little intrigue to someone who just comes in and spends so much.
I'm going to add one to sort of wrinkle, and I'm going to say I'm not going to be 100% surprised if the horse ends up in Europe.
Really? Why?
I mean, Smart Strike, Curlin's by Smart Strike, and Smart Strike can get you turf horse, the likes of English Channel. Curlin, as you might remember, tried the turf one time and was something other than an abject failure.
He was second to Red Rocks.
So I think Smart Strike is an each-way sort of sire. I think he can get you a good turf runner. I think Curlin has proven that he can catch a turf runner as well. More than that, the female family is definitely tilted towards turf. The Dam, who was a champion in New Zealand, champion sprinter, is a half-sister to Anthony Van Dyke, who won the Epsom Derby this year.
What's your favorite?
Sorry, Epsom Derby.
What's your favorite beer?
Oh, gosh.
Come on, I see.
I'm going to say Stella Artois, just because I like saying Stella Artois.
I bet you a case of Stella Artois versus, and I'm getting the raw end of this bargain, because I'm a Rolling Rock guy. Case of Stella Artois versus a case of Rolling Rock, this horse winds up in Bob Baffert's barn.
Okay.
Jan?
Saratoga 2036, how about that?
Witness.
Okay, right. Witness. Yeah, okay. You'd have to listen to our first podcast to understand that. Okay, we have a witness. Case of beer. I've got Baffert, and you've got every other trainer in the world. If he sends a horse to Venezuela, you win the bet, okay?
You should get more than a case if he goes to Venezuela. Yeah, okay. Before we move on from Keeneland September, I kind of wanted to mention the sire power at the very, very top. You know, you think of horses like Into Mischief and American Pharaoh, very, very fashionable sires, and I obviously would never say a disparaging word about them, but when you look at the horses that are consistently selling for seven figures, you look at three sires, really. You look at Tappet, Warfront, and now Curlin has kind of emerged into that group in the last couple of years, and it's interesting because they're not too old. Warfront, I think, is 17, Tappet's 18, Curlin's only 15, so it's interesting to see this kind of upper echelon define itself at these sales, and I think it's going to be that way for at least the next couple of years, if not the next 5 or 6 years. Al, have you noticed that?
I mean, I think the Curlin phenomenon as a sire that's truly arrived on the scene commercially is more of a last couple of years phenomenon. Mm-hmm. He had some good horses at Saratoga this year. He's been represented by 5 7-figure horses already in the first 3 days at Keeneland. Medaglia d'Oro is another consistent sire of 7-figure horses. He's had 4. What's interesting to me these days is that I've just said for many years that there are any number of really good sires that can get you a racehorse. And so there are 7 horses that between them they've combined for $19 million horses so far. American Pharaoh now with a couple, Pioneer the Nile with 3, even Union Rags had a 7-figure horse yesterday. So, I think as buyer you have many choices, and that that's a good thing. That's something that bodes well for the game.
I don't think we should turn this into a political show, but I think this is emblematic of what's happening in this country as a whole. And we're finding there's a separation between not only the rich and the middle class, but now the super rich and even the rich. I mean, the guy that's worth $10 million, you know, might as well be, picking quarters up off the sidewalk compared to some of the people that shop at these sales. And, you know, the game is now dominated by these people. And you're talking about, you know, 20, 25 people. And nobody goes to the sales and says, I want to buy a horse that's going to win a $38,000 allowance race at Remington Park someday. Every single one of these guys is doing the same thing. They want to buy the next superstar so then they can turn around and cash in on them to have the next superstar stallion. And so these guys have the money to pay what it takes So they're not going to fool around with anything other than the A plus 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 sires. And, you know, again, it's the movement of just the wealth to, you know, the top end is what's going on in this entire country. And, you know, there's only a certain amount of people that can afford these horses, and they're going to be the ones that are going to buy them. Simple and fast. If you're a guy like, I mean, Sheikh Mohammed, not being American, doesn't really qualify, but if you're a guy like Larry Best, you know, who seems to have, you know, an endless supply of money, he's not looking to win the Oklahoma Derby. He wants to win the Kentucky Derby, and he is not going to buy it. Alan, you mentioned some fantastic sires there, but everything he buys costs at least $800,000 or $900,000, if not more. And I'm sure if you looked up some sort of statistics, most of them would be by the sires that you say. So if he says, "If I've got enough money to buy the very best there is, why should I settle for anything else?"
Well, I think similar to my point before about leveling the playing field, I think that's why this is interesting and why we keep coming back and why these guys keep coming back to these sales, because there's no guarantee in racing. You know, super, super rich people and generally make very low risk investments, you know, things that are low yield but pretty much guaranteed to grow over time. Racing's not like that. These guys are losing money most of the time, and there's no guarantee that the $8.2 million horse that Mandy Pope just bought is going to be any more likely than a $30,000 horse later in the sale to win the Kentucky Derby. So I take your point, and I think that there is an interesting contrast in racing that it is more of a meritocracy, and either the horses can run or they can't. And yeah, if you have deeper pockets, you have a better chance because, you know, you're casting more lots, or, you know, there's no guarantee in racing. And I think that's what keeps people coming back at the high end, at the low end, and us as fans.
The thing about this, if every one of these people who got very wealthy, some might have inherited, but most of them got very wealthy by being very smart businessmen or women. If they ran their businesses like they run their stables, they probably all would have gone bankrupt within 2 weeks. But they're spending money on a dream. Right. And what is the price of that? You know, okay, somebody who can afford it says, okay, coming into the 2020 Derby, I've lost $100 million buying racehorses over the years, but I just won the 2020 Kentucky Derby. Would I trade that? If I had to go back and do it all over again and not lose that $100 million, I bet you 99% of them would say no. Yeah. It was worth it to win the Kentucky Derby. It's all about chasing the dream. The Kentucky Derby, most part, but, you know, Breeders' Cup Classic, and then, of course, you know, having the kind of stallion that, like a Tappet, that someday, you know, might stand for $300,000 or $400,000. It's about chasing a dream. Is there any dumber investment in the world than playing Powerball? I mean, what's the takeout on that? 97% or something like that. But the jackpot gets up to $300-400 million. They're lined up around the block because they're chasing a dream. So these guys are buying. This is the rich person's equivalent of playing Powerball.
Yep.
I'd also say, guys like Mike Rapoli, guys like Peter Brandt, and certainly the Coolmore team have the financial wherewithal and capital to buy these horses on their own. It's interesting that there's an increasing, they're increasingly inclined to partner up on these horses and spread the risk. So you've seen tickets signed by Rapoli, MV Magner, Peter Brandt in a variety of partnerships. Hey, that's an interesting thing too, because they do have the firepower to own these horses outright, and they choose to partner up. So
yeah, and then you bring that up. Sid Fernando had a good piece in the Thoroughbred Daily News last Thursday about the Phippses, who are now starting to sell yearlings. But they also mentioned in the article that they have a horse. The example was Performer, a horse who ran a really nice race at Saratoga the other day and won, and probably is headed to graded stakes, if not grade one races in the future. The quote was from Daisy Phipps, who said that normally if you have a horse like that who wins at Saratoga and everybody's watching, your phone's ringing off the hook with offers. But she said no one ever calls them because no one is ever used to the Phippses wanting partners on anything. They've always gone it their own. They've always done their own thing and gone it alone. So I think that point is well taken, that even at the top of the game, outside of Coolmore and Godolphin, a lot of these people in a lot of these big ownerships are looking to partner up and spread the risk. All right, we'll move on now to we're going to recap last weekend real quick. The first ever Turf Trinity wrapped up at Belmont. You had two Euros who won. Actually, Euros ran 1, 2, 3 in the Jockey Club Derby. Our guest last week, John Green, Thread of Blue, I thought ran pretty well. It's just probably a little bit too far for him. I think at the eighth pole, he still looked pretty good, but just came up a little like wary late. I think the most noteworthy thing about this initial Turf Trinity is that Chad Brown, nowhere to be found, at least on the win end. And I just started thinking about that, and I thought about, you know, there's obviously major exceptions. Lady Eli comes to mind. But I feel like when he dominates American turf racing, it's mostly with late developing three-year-olds or Euro acquisitions as 4- and 5-year-olds. Not to say he can't win a three-year-old grade one. He's obviously done a bunch. But I think having it early in the season especially might level the playing field and might give these other trainers a better chance. And I think with more Euro participation, it makes it more of a gamble and more of an even kind of proposition for people. And I think having the 12 furlong Jockey Club Derby, I think, really helped too, because mile and 3/16 around those tight turns at Saratoga, I don't know that that's going to entice a lot of European participation. But I think if they stretch these races out, I think that makes more sense for them to come over. And we saw that they're still as potent as ever.
Joe, there's a couple things I want to disagree with you on. First of all, where has it gotten to the point where Chad Brown has to be perfect? And it's his own fault. That's a bad word to use, but you know what I mean. It's because when he wins absolutely everything in sight, and then all of a sudden, you know, he goes 0-for-6 in the series. It's like, oh my God. I mean, this is like, Clayton Kershaw going out and pitching 1 1/3 innings and giving up 9 runs. It just happens every once in a while. And he didn't have the ammunition, but he's won plenty of three-year-old grass races over the years. And remember, he had a filly coming into the year that probably would have dominated the filly circuit in newspaper of record, and she just, something went amiss with her. He had to stop on her this year. What's your favorite beer?
I would say Lagunitas.
I never heard of that.
Yeah, it's a California beer.
Okay, all right. Case of Lagunitas versus a case of Rolling Rock. In the next, let's see, 4 years, 24 of these races, I will set the over-under that Chad Brown will win 8.5 of them. What do you want to take, the over or the under?
I'll take the under, yeah.
All right, you're on, Alan. Yeah. Damn, I would be drinking good in a couple of
Hope
years.
You got a good beer distributor.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. He's too good. And it just, he can't win everything. It's a credit to him that we sit back here and say that, oh, my God, the guy, the 6 races, you know, when any of them. We're not talking about, you know, nobody said, oh, Todd Pletcher didn't win any of them. Or nobody said Steve Asmussen didn't win any of them. Or nobody said that, Shelton Gay didn't win any of them. You know, it just goes to show you how far he's come, especially with grass races, where the expectations are so high. He just can't win everything. I'm sure there's games where Ty Cobb went 0-for-6 at the plate. It happens.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Digital Age was a nice low odds kind of horse to bet against the other day, being by Invincible Spirit and trying to get a distance like 12 furlongs. But I want to take the discussion in a slightly different direction. I saw a lot of disparaging comments about the concept on Twitter and the like. And I don't know if people were dissatisfied that American-based horses didn't win, or you had hyped Euros that came over and paid, you know, $6 to win. I'm a fan of turf racing, so I mean, I have to preface what I say by that. But, for me, it's utterly enjoyable to see a horse like Adisa or a horse like Spanish Mission, with solid European form, come across and run their races here. A horse like Spanish Mission took a pass on the last English Classic, the St. Ledger, to come run in this race. I honestly thought on paper he was a standout, and when his price clicked up over to 2-1, sometimes 2-1 represents value, mm-hmm. And I saw it that way on Saturday. I give a bunch of credit to Martin Panta, who, you know, he inaugurated the American Oaks in his Hollywood days, got horses to come over from Japan and Australia, and I give him credit for thinking outside the box.
You know, I would agree with you, Alan. Are these the most compelling races? No. They don't compare to the Dirt Triple Crown. They don't compare to the Travers. They don't compare to the Whitney. I can probably name 20 more races that they don't compare to. But NYRA has so much money. It's because of the slots. It's like they don't know what to do with it. So, you know, their choices were to put something together like this that was creative, would bring horses over from Europe, you know, maybe eventually catch on with the fans. The first leg of it, the Stars and Stripes Championship, I think really has caught on. I think that the second and third legs might take some time to catch on more with the fans. But, you know, the alternative is to run the Ashley T. Cole as your feature on a Saturday. So who wants that? So, you know, he's not going to get – we know he's not going to get Coolmore's best horse to come over. It's just not going to happen. But, you know, he got some very interesting European horses, got some competitive races, and people love to bet on good turf horses. So, and they have the money, the purse money to spend on it. So, yeah, why would anybody criticize that?
Yeah, and the thing is, like, one of the things when I first became a racing fan, one of the things I loved about the Breeders' Cup was getting to see these foreign horses come over who, other than the lines in the form, I had never really seen or heard of. That's a big thing in terms of creating like a more cohesive global sport. And the same thing happened with Enable last year. You know, when Enable came over, that was a landmark thing for a horse that good, fresh off an ARC win, the talk of the world, to come to the U.S., didn't have to, and win the Breeders' Cup Turf. I think this is obviously a much smaller scale version of it, at least at this point. But anything where you can bring different continents together and maybe get a European player to bet on a dirt race, you know, I definitely watch a lot more European races than I used to because I've gotten attached to horses like Enable. So I think that's a point well made. And anytime you can make it a more global sport, either here or abroad, I think that's a good thing. I think the same thing has happened in reverse with Royal Ascot, with Teppan going over there and Wesley Ward horses going over there and being successful. Anything to increase the interest on a global scale, I think, is a good thing. And as far as the Chad Brown thing, you know, it's fodder for podcasts, Bill. You know, that's the storyline. That's when Todd Pletcher didn't win the Derby forever. That was the story. You know, and he'd won a million other big races, but everyone asked about him winning the Derby.
He'll win 5 out of 6 next year. I'm not betting a case of beer on that, but okay. You heard it here first. He's 5 out of 6. It's just, like I said, you know, Willie Mays, every once in a while, struck. Yeah, it just happens.
Yeah. You know, it's a credit to him that you get to a certain point where people have to, like, poke little holes.
I know people, when this thing was created, I know people were calling it the Chad Brown Turf Crown.
I know. That's why it's a story that he didn't win any of them.
Just write him the check right now. Yeah. Just, you know, save time. Just here, Chad, take the check, deposit it, and, you know, if anything goes wrong, you can always pay us back. Yeah. So,
that's why it's a story when he doesn't win any. But, yeah, I'm sure there's plenty of wins in the Turf Trinity coming for Chad Brown in the future. Let's talk very briefly about the Jockey Club's 140 mare cap. I thought, Bill, you had an interesting story. You were comparing it to when the standardbred business did something similar. What were your takeaways from that?
Well, a couple of things. And first of all, I'm continuing to work on this and want to get some more facts. And, you know, is it a good idea? Is it a bad idea? Not being a scientist, I have no idea. And I think unless you are, you know, one of these, you know, really intelligent people that understands, you know, they're throwing, this has been some of the toughest interviews I've ever done. I hate this because these scientists, they start throwing words at me that heterozygosity. What the hell is heterozygosity? Then I got to go Google and look it up and learn how to spell it and everything. And it's just like, you know, what? You know, they just can't like dumb themselves down enough to talk to somebody like me. I have a couple takeaways. First of all, I know when this story first came out that there were talks of lawsuits. That you know, right away you think restraint of trade. You know, if the poster child for this is into mischief because he's such a popular sire and he's bred to well over 140 mares a year. So, and I believe in a story that T.D. Thornton wrote that people from Spencer sort of implied, you know, hey, you haven't heard of the last of this yet from us. The So anyways, to back up, the United States Trotting Association back in 2009 did exactly what the Jockey Club is attempting to do and limited the books and mares to 140. As a matter of fact, I bet you that's where the Jockey Club got the number. So one of the things that I learned was I talked to a very bright person who's the head of Hanover Shoe Farms. I mean, even thoroughbred people know what Hanover Shoe Farms is. And he said that he contacted antitrust lawyers, and they told him that if anybody sues you, they're going to get laughed out of court. They have no case whatsoever. And I have no – and nothing ever happened. The rule passed, and he said, matter of fact, some depositions were taken. It didn't even get past that point because it was so obvious that they weren't going to win. So if anybody is interested in suing the Jockey Club, they're probably wasting their time. You know, you never know. Maybe different judge, different era, time, but they're probably wasting their time. But the other thing that I'd like to see out of this is that, and a lot of people have brought this up to me, where's the science? And, you know, this to me, there's a little bit too much guesswork in this because, you know, in this day and age, we have scientific studies that know everything. Is the level of inbreeding that we have in thoroughbred racing weakening the breed or not? And I don't think anybody knows the answer to that question. Now, certainly inbreeding is not a good thing, you know, especially as it gets more and more intense. I mean, if you start breeding, into mischief to into mischief mares, you probably got a problem on your hands. But thoroughbred people have been pretty careful to avoid anything close to that sort of scenario. So I'd like to see a little bit more science, a little bit more research on this before maybe they move forward. Maybe there is some scientific study. The Jockey Club has been very vague about this. I mean, I flat out asked them, do you got a study? What have you learned? And their answer is basically, we're not ready to reveal that information. Huh? You know, like, well, really? Like, why? Why would that be your answer? I don't know. So we'll see where this goes. It's going to take a long time to pass. I hate to be wishy-washy here, but I'm somewhere in the middle. I don't know enough about it to form really the science of it to really form an opinion. But I would say that we need more science. And getting back to the standard bred thing, I learned later that. The guy actually told me that did a survey for the standardbreds, and he did say this is off the top of my head, but remember it's a much smaller breed. They breed about one third as many horses as the thoroughbreds do. He said that at the worst of this, 60% of the horses, standardbreds, were bred by six sires. Now that's crazy. That number would bear no resemblance whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the number is in thoroughbred racing, but it wouldn't be anywhere close to that. So, you know, they obviously clearly had a much worse inbreeding problem mm-hmm. than the thoroughbreds did. So, you know, maybe it was, you know, a dire situation that they said, look, we got to fix this right now. Do the thoroughbreds need to fix this in the next 24 hours? I don't know.
So more science, less science words, I think, is what I'm getting from you.
Oh, fewer man, just, science words. Just like I've got three or four more interviews to do with these. These people are too smart for me. I can't. You know.
Yeah.
And they don't. They don't know how to talk. They can't dumb it down enough. Yeah. I can understand it. No, I hate doing stories.
Yeah, I always avoid those stories like the plague.
I hate doing stories like this. I've already like written six words in stories that I have never heard of before. But these guys just throw them out like, you know, there's something that you learned in Dick and Jane in first grade. So
this is something that broke probably about a month ago, and we didn't get a chance to talk about it yet, but the proposed new dates for California racing in 2020, pretty much scrapping the Los Alamitos fall meet that used to bridge Del Mar and Santa Anita, or we used to be the Oak Tree meet at Santa Anita. Also, more dates at Santa Anita in 2020, which I thought was a weird thing, a weird reaction to all the problems that they had. Let's run more races at Santa Anita. That'll solve it. Bill, you had an opinion about this, and I think I echoed it a little bit about how Los Alamitos really stepped up for California racing in the past, and it's kind of getting left in the lurch here.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I mean, first of all, if you just want to look at it from a bottom line, and you can certainly make the argument that, you know, who should be racing, all things being equal, Santa Anita or Los Alamitos, well, that's a no-brainer. Santa Anita has a turf course. Los Alamitos doesn't. At Santa Anita, all the good jockeys ride. At Los Alamitos, they all go to Hawaii for vacation for 2 weeks. The handle is much smaller there. But so, you know, what's best for California racing overall? Yeah, probably running at Santa Anita. But there's also, you know, you don't throw people under the bus when that came through for you. And I think the disloyalty to the Dr. Allred, who owns Los Alamitos, was somewhat galling. I mean, when Hollywood Park closed, and remember, people just remember Hollywood Park closing. Actually, two racetracks in California closed because the place that used to have these dates, Fairplex, closed as well. So they lost two racetracks. They realized that they were going to have a serious problem with stalls, and also they felt that, you know, it wasn't sustainable to have only two racetracks try to combine 52 weeks of racing a year. I'd love to see them take 2 months off somewhere, but that's a story for another day, and it's not going to happen. So I looked up a story that I found in the Los Angeles Times. It was written in 2014 when this all started. Allred put up $5 million of his own money. He had to do two things. He had to build a whole bunch of new stalls to house the thoroughbreds that were going to come into because they desperately needed stall space. Apparently, that's where Baffert keeps all his two-year-olds, which I didn't realize until maybe at first.
And then until they're really on. Yeah.
And also because it was a some sort of bullring track. I don't know if it's half mile, 5/8 or whatever, which would have been completely inappropriate for racing. They had to extend the track to a mile. Guy spent $5 million and, you know, and did it, you know, to be a good guy. And how do they reward him? Take your dates and you know, well, you know, we don't want your rinky-dink racetrack. We're going to Santa Anita. I mean, talk about, like, just lack of loyalty and lack of appreciation for what this guy did for California racing. And if you read some of the quotes that he gave to the California Horse Racing Board, he was pissed off, and I don't blame him. And, you know, but I don't think there's really anything he can do about it. He kind of got, other than he probably feels at the end of the day, these people took advantage of me.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, I'm a bit of a traditionalist, for lack of a better term. I agree. I mean, I think the fact that we're going to give more dates to Santa Anita in the aftermath of everything that happened in the last 12 months or, you know, 9 to 12 months, you know, certainly raises some red flags, certainly raises some questions. And you can't help but feel bad for the people at Los Alamitos, like you say, Bill. You know, Mr. Allred, you know, put his heart and soul into trying to rescue California racing when it needed it most, and you know, it just gets swatted away like this is you know, it's just indignant.
I mean, yeah, threw the man right under the bus.
Yeah, it's I feel like it's a little bit of a trend. People talk about getting rid of Aqueduct in the winter, but I mean, you need a blue collar racetrack where you can run these horses, you know, in the off season. And Aqueduct served its purpose just like Los Alamitos does. Had to bring it back to New York. I'm sorry. we'll touch on this weekend's racing a little bit. The big stuff is happening north of the border at Woodbine. We've got the Grade 1 Woodbine Mile, a couple other Grade 1s. Interesting feel for the Woodbine Mile. 11 horses, 8-5. Favorite on the morning line is Got Stormy, who we obviously saw come back and on 7 days rest and win the 4-star Dave at Saratoga. But there's a couple other interesting horses in here. Raging Bull, who Got Stormy beat that day, will take another shot. Awesome Tank, Philly, another Philly, who ran a good second to Sister Charlie at Arlington, the Beverly D. You got Synchrony cutting back to a mile. Luke Cullen, who I'm a fan of, really starting to come into his own a little bit. So it's a really interesting race. Bill, I know you're a big fan of Get Stormy and the Cassie and Gary Barber Enterprise. Bringing her back on such short
notice. Yeah, I've become a big fan of this horse because the move to run this horse back 7 days in the 4-star day was so ballsy. and it paid off. You know how like everybody says, if I were a rich guy and I own horses, everybody says, oh, my trainer's so patient. I want a patient trainer. I want a patient trainer. You know what I would say? I want an impatient trainer. I want the most impatient trainer in the world. I want my horse to run 35 goddamn times a year, because when he runs six, how much chance do you have to make money? And the funny thing about it was, you know, Cassie was a great guy. He was very open. He says, I'm not the guy that decided to do this. Barber, the two Garys, I get mixed up, Gary Barber and Gary West, basically said, you know, how's the horse doing? Great. Is there any reason not to run him in the four-star Dave? A grade one, winning you're in, I believe, for the Breeders' Cup Mile. And Cassie kind of said, well, 7 days, but other than that, no. He says, screw the 7 days, let's run him back. I just think the guy deserves to be rewarded, and he has been rewarded. That was a great win in the four-star Dave. And, you know, this filly is getting really good. Now, she's not Teppan level yet by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, if she wins this race and she continues to perform the way she's been performing, we might be talking about Teppan too. Teppan won this race, this very same race, in 2016, and also she really didn't get good until she was a four-year-old. Her three-year-old year was kind of modest. Remember, they started off from the dirt. Mm-hmm. Alan, I also want to stump you. I already give this away, but name the most famous dirt race Teppan ever won.
Oh, I know this one.
That she ever won?
Yeah.
The Delta Jackpot.
Well, the Delta Princess.
Sorry.
Yeah, okay. Damn yes. it. Damn you're good. Yeah. Yeah. Teppan won at a bullring track in Louisiana, and then went on to be Teppan. So she didn't really develop till she was four. Looks like, she was good as a three-year-old, but she was at her very best as a four-year-old. Looks like this horse might be following the same path. Now, it's a long, long, long way to go before that she becomes Teppan. But I hope she wins this and has three starts between now and the Breeders' Cup, because that's how horses, you can't make money leaving horses in the barn, and Gary West proved that. And what had happened to the horse? Did the horse, like the Wicked Witch of the West, just like, you know, disintegrate? No, the horse is fine, it's coming back, is now going to be the favorite in $1 million race in Canada.
Yeah, and it trickles down too, because you get bigger field size, it's good for the bettors. I don't think you're going to find anybody, except for maybe some of the cautious trainers, overly cautious trainers in some cases, who have a case to make against running their horses more often.
Yeah, I'm telling you, I would tell my trainer, if my horses don't start an average of 25 times a year, you're fired. Yeah.
Los Alamitos.
Yeah, right, all at Los Alamitos. There you go. You have to run they probably only run 25 days a year, so you'd have to run every single card at Los Alamitos. But there you go, yeah.
No, you know, obviously in other parts of the world, owners and trainers are much more apt to run their female horses against male rivals. I honestly wish it would be done more in this country. So, full marks to Gary Barber and Mark Cassie for trying her in the four-star Dave. Ventura for Jevon Farms also won the Woodbine Mile, another female. It can be done. On paper, even though she admittedly got a setup in the four-star Dave, on paper there's nothing else that really would scare the heck out of you.
Yeah.
Raging Bull is certainly a nice horse.
Didn't we just go through saying Chad Brown's a bomb? Didn't we just spend like 20 minutes on that?
Those are your words.
I never said that.
But yeah, she put that field to sleep too in the four-star Dave, like pretty quickly. The race was over within a couple of jumps. One more race I wanted to touch on before we sign off here. Obviously, the disclaimer is that it is absurdly early, but if you had to pick a favorite right now for the 2020 Kentucky Derby, kind of think you'd zero in on Dennis's Moment.
Really?
Yeah, I mean.
Okay, wow, that's a big statement.
So, yeah, Dennis's Moment was very highly touted first time out, dumped the rider, but still ran a pretty remarkable race, then came back a month later at Ellis Park, won by, I'm looking at 19 and a quarter lengths at Ellis, and got a 97 buyer, highest buyer earned by a two-year-old thus far through September 11th, and has come back, hasn't missed a beat. It's worked four times since, progressively faster, five furlongs at a minute and a fifth, five furlongs at 59 and three, and then most recently five furlongs, 58 and four-fifths seconds. Gets a new rider, Irad Ortiz Jr. coming in for the mount for the 1 mile and 1/16 Iroquois Stakes Saturday at Churchill Downs. Just wanted to touch on him real quick so that if he does come back and win the Kentucky Derby, I can say I was in on the ground floor.
Yeah, it sounds like, I mean, are you ready to have the statue, like, built already, you know, like, put out in front of Churchill Downs?
Well, the thing that kills me, it's kind of like the American Pharaoh thing where they misspelled Pharaoh.
Yeah.
It's Dennis's. It's supposed to be S apostrophe S.
Oh, I just, I don't get me started on that. I have so disagree. I have grammatical, Sue Finley, the editor of Thoroughbred Daily News, I argue with her about that all the time.
But the apostrophe is supposed to be if it's a plural thing.
No, I just disagree. I don't know. That's not what Mrs. Rosencrantz taught me in sixth grade. I'm sorry. But anyways.
I think most people are going to call him Dennis Moment.
Okay. But anyways, but you're right. I think, honestly, Joe, I mean, nobody can make a favorite for the Kentucky Derby on September 11th. I mean, that's impossible.
I think there are some Vegas sports books that will take your action right now.
I mean, you know, more than likely, the favorite Kentucky Derby perhaps hasn't even run yet, mm-hmm. Which has been the case at this time for several of the last few years. I mean, of course, Justify being the best example. But, no, I'm all with you. I mean, this horse looks like an absolute killer on paper and, you know, does have to go two turns for the first time. And if he repeats that race and wins again by 19 and a quarter, you know, we've got something. The only thing I would say to him, you know, like, and I'm guilty of this as anybody, but, like, you know, we're all just like so buyer centric. Mm-hmm. It's just like, matter of fact, the buyers have made me a much worse handicap. I'm dead serious about this because I get lazy. Okay, this horse runs 90s. Everybody else runs 80s. I'm betting on him. And I don't look between the lines or look as carefully as at things that I probably used to. This race was at Ellis Park. It was not exactly at Royal Ascot. Now, I know the Ellis Park meet has improved quite a bit with the purse supplements, purse money that they've gotten from Kentucky Downs. But, you know, if you won by 14 and a quarter at Saratoga, you know, maybe I'd be a little bit more. I mean, I probably will pick this horse when it comes down to it. But I'd probably be a little bit higher. And, you know, loyalty doesn't go too far in this game. We got a nice horse, Miguel Mena, Get Lost. Yeah. Irad, what are you doing on Saturday? I can't blame him if the horse is that good. Bring in the best job.
Yeah, I agree about the buyer thing. I would say that I would be more likely to like this horse because he drew outside. And he showed, you know, I know he didn't have the rider on, but he showed in that debut that he's okay coming from off the pace. So I think those are more reasons to like him rather than just the buyer. The buyer thing is just, it's a distinction, I think, to have.
He had 118 pounds off that.
He still rallied, man. he could have sulked, but he didn't.
Yes.
Yeah. Hey, Al?
Yeah, and Dale Romans has used this race before. He won a few years ago with a horse called Cleburne. Remember Cleaver?
Mm. No, I remember not this time. I thought that's the one you were going to go
we're
for.
We're getting there, right. Joe. Right.
I'll say one more thing. I think we mentioned this about some other trainer last week or maybe the week before. You know, there's certain trainers. I think I said that about Asmussen. There are certain trainers who, like, you know before their careers are over going to win the Kentucky Derby. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just Steve Asmussen's, he's had a better career than Dale Romans. No knock on Romans because few trainers have had better careers than Steve Asmussen. But you know sooner or later, someday he's going to win the Kentucky Derby, if not three or four. Chad Brown, even though, you know, 65% of his barn, 75% of his barn, turf horses, I'd say the same thing about him. I'd put Dale Romans in that class too. Mm-hmm. Just seems like there's a Derby with his name on it. So out there. So, that's another thing. I mean, that's kind of just mumbo jumbo and not very scientific. But, you know, I think Dale might be due.
Just want to finish that point.
Yeah, and I think they had very high hopes for Not This Time when he won. I think he won his maiden similarly impressively.
Six furlongs, yeah.
Right? You know, listen, not too many two-year-olds, no matter Saratoga or Kalamazoo down. I had to work it in.
Okay.
But not too many two-year-olds. I mean, this is a debut for all intents and purposes. Not too many two-year-olds are going to shade 122 with a 12-second come home, 12-second final eighth of a mile. I mean, he's obviously doing some running. He was drawn wide that day. He has post 8 in the field of 10. You figure that Irad's going to kick him away and let him just let him roll. And yeah, the marginal comment last time is demolished.
I was going to bring that up.
Demolished field.
I love when that happens. I love when such a blowout that there's nothing else to say. It's kind of like when we're riding a race out sometimes and a horse just has the entire stretch of themselves. You don't know really what to say.
Okay, and I have one final thought. I hope we will properly archive this podcast because I'm getting two cases of Rolling Rock eventually from one from each of you. I don't remember the exact bets or whatever, but I don't want somebody to say, oh, I don't remember that. Two cases, you know, and you're lucky I didn't ask for Heineken or everything. You can buy Rolling Rock or what for a case for like, you know, $1.49. So, you know, I'm giving you guys a break, but, you know. Okay, two cases of each of you, Al.
You're on.
Al,
you're
and,
on.
And Joe.
Yep.
I want my case of Rolling. When the time comes and the bets are settled, case of Rolling Rock.
You got it.
For it.
All right, that's it for this
podcast.
Week.
Has been brought to you by Rolling Rock Beer.
All right.
America's favorite, brewed in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. America's favorite since 1873.
All right. On that note, this has been the TDN Riders Room Podcast. For Bill Finley and Alan Carrasso, this is Joe Bianca, Associate Editor at the TDN. We will see you next week.